Welcome back to Pax Europiana, to my podcast about peace in Europe. This is the section about EU days, European celebration days, and remarkable days which really everybody should know in Europe. And thanks for listening. Today it's actually the 1st of February, which I want to talk about it. And that's a very remarkable day for our relation with China and for the Chinese to get the so-called most favored nation status by the US. Now you will say, what this does matter for the Europeans? Why we should celebrate this every year? Why? What is actually the most favored nation status? And why is this remarkable that the US gave that to China? And what it matters to the Europeans? Look, that's a momentous event of geostrategic most utter significance in every aspect. Yeah? And please, I will explain it now. First of all, the United States, as you know, I'm sure, is the lead power of the free world, and the European and American economic space are highly integrated and highly interconnected by cross equity. We have a joint volume of American investment, foreign direct investment, in Europe of about 3 trillion and a similar 3 trillion of European capital also in the United States. So this is a huge united space of a common economic area. Unfortunately, it's not a free trade area because we have forgotten to do TTIP. I'm sorry, I had to mention it. Yeah. So anyhow, so that's a quite logic. What the Americans do economically and what we do matters mutually very much, because our companies are interconnected, our markets are interconnected, and we are one common area of the West. Not perfect, but more or less. So, secondly, why it matters very much, because in the 70s and in the 60s, or let's go back to history in that point, yeah, in the year when the United States were created after the First World War, it was already 5 members of the United Nations Security Council, but it was Free China, not the Communist People's Republic. It was Free China, which is now in Taiwan, basically. And that was the China which was the Western ally in World War II. But the Soviet-backed communists have won the Second World War, and the Soviet Union has won the Second World War, but didn't stop it, but continued it in China. And basically, with the help of the communist Chinese, they have taken over control first of the Japanese occupied territories, and then they have defeated in the Chinese Civil War the Chiang Kai-sheks, the nationalists. And so China was, as we say, China was lost in 49, lost for the free world. And it actually has then started a period of, I would say 30 terrible years for the Chinese. 30 terrible years. Yeah. Obviously, the years before that, the 30 years before, were also quite terrible already, because China was in the status of constant civil war before. Since the fall of the Qin dynasty in 1912, the last emperor, Puyi, and then before, it was also then actually, when you're very honest and when we're looking back, the crisis of China has started with the last big empire of China. This was the big warrior king, Jiangxi. My Chinese might not be perfect, but in 1820. In 1820, the last great emperor and conqueror of China, who has really enlarged the empire and also defended it from Western intrusion, he died. His successor was much less successful. And also the Europeans, after the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the real start of the Industrial Revolution, we were basically in a position, I was obviously not part of it, but the Europeans and also then the Americans, but led by the British in many ways, we were ready then to roll out the colonial imperialist century from 1815 onwards, from the Vienna Congress. And China was on the agenda. China had this government change in 1820. And from then on, from that moment onwards, actually China was going down, and it was all this cadence of the Opium Wars and the Boxer Rebellion and the internal civil war of China, in which all European powers participated. this Beijing revolution, Taiping revolution. My Chinese is really not very good. Nevertheless, so ultimately from 1820 it was going downwards before actually China was one of the dominant global powers. Maybe not a global power, but certainly the dominant Asian power. But that has changed in that period after 1820. And actually then it was, and that matters for this story very much, you might remember this amazing turnaround of Japan, the Meiji Revolution. I will do also a specific podcast about that one. But it's an amazing progress of modernization, opening of Japan. And basically, to some extent, what is happening today is very much a similar process like what Japan has done after 1870s and onwards, and has been so tremendously successful. And now, actually, what I think the Chinese know history very well, and they basically repeat this role model, hopefully not ending so badly. I know that I don't want to even imply, because I'm very optimistic on our partnership with China. Anyhow, I digress. What has happened in 1980 is really historic, because it has led to an enormous change of the global prosperity, because the Chinese, they had in this year, when they basically signed on this historic visit of Deng Xiaoping after he took power fully, Mao died in 76, and then 78, Mao had, after some internal struggle, he got the full control of the party and of the state. First thing he did, he went to Washington, made this legendary visit to Carter on the invitation of Carter. And in the beginning of 79, they have already mutually officially recognized each other, because until then it was still the USA recognizing Taiwan. And that has shifted then to the People's Republic. Then Deng could go because of the recognition. And then it was a really big media hit. There are wonderful videos out there how this, with Deng Xiaoping, with the cowboy hat, with the Stetson hat, in somewhere in Texas or somewhere, I don't know exactly the location, but he made a really big trip to see America and compare it also with China. And that led then to the initiation of the process in the legislative approval. And then came the most favored nation status, entered in force on the 1st of February 1980. And I repeat the numbers. China, which had also at that time over a billion people, had a GDP of 200 billion in 1918. That was about the GDP of maybe Sweden and Austria together at that time. So you have to see how minuscule the situation and how tragically underdeveloped China was after all this, let's say, overall 140 terrible years, I would say, from being a really big power still in 1820 to being such a miserable condition in 1980. And then from 1980, it's a lot of numbers, but it's quite logical. From 1980, 200 billion, it took for five times more, it took about 17 years to 1997. And then it was 1 trillion. And in 2001, China was allowed to join the WTO. That is basically a mutually permanent most favored nation status. And this was created in 1995. China was allowed in 2001. And then it was from that moment to 97, I have the number 1 trillion. It's good to remember. In 2019, it's 14 trillion. And here we come to really historic times, because this is another 22 years. And it has basically 14 times more GDP, China. I mean, that's, of course, a big change in the world, yeah? It's changing all the dynamics of the world, but for the better. I mean, so many people lifted out of poverty, so many people adding to global supply of goods, services, technology, thinking, and creativity, ideas, and contribute. And this is really tremendously for the good. Obviously, some people are afraid, because some people still think, you know, automatically, even when the Americans or the Europeans are just one smaller percentage of the global population, basically, let's say together, it's maybe 1.2 billion people, if you see it, or 1 billion all over North America, Canada, and free Europe, 1.1. And you know, this just 1.1. We are 8 billion together. We shouldn't have 30% or 50% or whatever kind of, just the normal share of global GDP. And you know, that would be good. Yeah, I think so. It's not that we need to be, we can only be rich when the others are poor. No, when everybody in the world is much richer, we will also be much better. And we don't have bad conscience, and we don't have this kind of terrible wars and terrible atrocities, which are undermining our systems, obviously. So it's a tremendous force of the good. And it happened on the 1st of February 1980. And this was Deng Xiaoping. I have many things to say about him. I want to a little bit mention the short overview of the history, because there is, of course, in China now a little bit the idea that always was ever good. I mean, China was going through a terrible civil war until 1949. This war continued later then. Then there was, of course, purges and communist nonsense and disaster and terror. Then came the most terrible failure, that was the repeating of the Soviet planned economy in mostly rural and civil war destroyed China, which has been a complete disaster. That's the so-called Great Leap Forward. That was the slogan to name this 5 years plan from 1958. It was a complete disaster. Millions and millions dead. Yeah, it was complete disaster. And then when Mao Zedong saw that this was not really very successful, and all his peers, because in China, in many Asian societies, it's very important what your peers, your inner circle, always thinks about you. And Mao lost his face with all this nonsense, because they are also quite objective and scientific in China, and they see nonsense when they see it. And so he lost power, and then he started this terrible cultural revolution of revenge, which led to so much bloodshed from 68 onwards, and this kind of red terror which he released, and it was a total disaster. And it was by mere coincidence and good luck that Deng Xiaoping survived all this, and the power struggle afterwards with the Gang of Four. It was really a complete disaster. But Deng has survived. Deng has actually won this power struggle, and he managed then to reform the economy with his four freedoms and with the specific Chinese model. Let me make it very clear, I'm very anti-communist, and I really hope for freedom for China, for a free federal China. Nevertheless, after 140 years of chaos and war, atrocities and disaster, where also the Europeans have contributed enormously with all our one-sided treaties and all these military interventions and all this playing one side off against the other and all this messing around, hoping that to get rich of China. It was then the civil war, the Russian intervention, the Japanese intervention, the horrors of the Japanese intervention. So, and then also the internal fratricide after the civil war, and so on and so on and so on. And also this communist nonsense. Then suddenly after 140 years of complete chaos and war, there was a need for stability. And you know, I'm very much against the dogma of stability first and democracy later. But in the Chinese context, maybe it made some sense. And we have also to have some patience. And there is this big argument which some make now, that that the idea, which especially also the Germans, but the whole strategy of the breaking the communist China away from the Soviet Union and then reforming it, is based on the same strategy. It's change through trade. In Germany and Austria, we call it Wandel durch Handel, and this is change through trade. Some people say it failed, because still now China is not a democracy after our model. And I don't defend the Chinese system, which they will say they are like an internal democracy. They have found a new way of democratization inside the party. I think that's utter nonsense. Yeah, they have many issues. They are an authoritarian regime. There is no doubt about it. And we don't want a Chinese world, and we don't want to be dominated by them and hope for freedom. But, you know, on the other hand, also to say that to build some prosperity first and some decency and get in some kind of level of middle class, which is then able to carry democracy and also be educated individual in a free society. And who really tells all these people who say that this strategy didn't work, who tells you that it won't work in 20 years? Where's the argument here? You know, who said that it will work in 40 years of transformation? Who said that it will go fast? I mean, this is a momentous change. Imagine if peaceful transition to democracy and a free federal China is possible in, let's say, 20 years. It's well good enough. Who said in the year 2021 this must happen and it must happen now? I mean, nobody ever said that this can go so fast. And I know it's very painful for the people in Hong Kong, for the people in Xinjiang. My Chinese is not very good. The Turkish people, the Turkish minorities of the Uyghurs. Yeah. But on the other hand, I tell you that the point is that so many people have now first time heard about the Uyghurs. Yeah. And many people even have not heard about them. But now it's a big topic, not because of China suppressing them, because most of the people who make out of the Uyghurs now a big topic, they don't care for the Crimean Tatars in Russia. It's mainly a strategy to do this China bashing of Trump, basically, who was before in the 80s the big Japan basher, and now he has this China bashing in order to deflect from the real criminal activities of Russia in Ukraine, in Syria, in Georgia. And the people obviously are more afraid in some sense, yeah, from the Chinese, because it's more alien, they don't know it, it's yellow, it's wild, yeah, and it's a little bit stranger to our concept, obviously, yeah. And, you know, ultimately then the idea is, you know, the Russians are, they're also white, yeah. And this is the level of debate we have here, and this is the level of prejudice, yeah. And it's not rational, because the Chinese, and here I come back to the Cold War again, and to this historic momentous event of 79, and it's really important to understand what happened, yes. Because the Chinese, since the years 79 and 80, since the visit of Deng Xiaoping and the most favored nation status, they have not made any aggression anymore against Western interest. They are basically an ally in the Cold War. They are one of the reasons why the Cold War was won. Absolutely. They made secret agreement, military agreements with the American military advisor to be secure from the Soviet Union, to supply weapons to Afghanistan, fighting against paid by the Americans, yeah, to contain the Vietnamese and get the Vietnamese out of Cambodia and Laos, yeah, with American advisors, but with Chinese weapons, yeah. And from the moment, actually, the Chinese Communist Party was basically a Western ally. Not officially, because nobody wanted to have that officially. Certainly not the Americans, certainly not the Chinese, and certainly not the Soviet Union. So, because it was very complicated to explain. But why it happened, and this has to be understood again in the Cold War, and the same logic applies today, because Soviet Russia at that time was completely overreaching imperially. And here comes the most important moment in the history of the Sino-Chinese relations in the second part, was, of course, the brutal breakdown or whatever intervention, military intervention of the Warsaw Pact led by the Soviet Union into Czechoslovakia, because of the crime that they didn't want to be on the Soviet communism, but communism of their own choosing, yeah. Or socialism. And this kind of brotherly fratricide, yeah, and this really broke the already quite strained relation between Soviet Russia and the Chinese. And do not take it lightly, because some say, oh, yeah, they didn't care for human rights. No, they really cared very much. And the Chinese were really upset by this Brezhnev intervention and the Brezhnev doctrine and this kind of hitting hard against deviation, and that really they saw themselves as the next one probably, and they went to Romania to protest, they built this alliance with Albania and so on and so on, and they almost started a war against the Soviet Union in the March 69. So exactly that was the way, it was very serious, and this led also to the change of alliances. It was a momentous moment when Kissinger first went to China secretly, and then obviously in 72 Nixon went to China. I mean, that's the most famous visit. And obviously, it didn't lead completely when the situation in China was much too fragile. But it led to many things, because it was China getting the voting right in the UN back. Yeah? So communist China was getting the voting right. Still, the US didn't support that, but secretly, at least, it didn't block it. Yeah, and so it happened. And then there was this approximation and this kind of softening up of China during this very complicated moment still of the succession struggle of China, of Mao in 76. And it gradually, in this most terrible 70s, it was a gradual process. But when then Deng won and he went to the White House, don't forget, I think it's quite a tremendous moment. Yeah, I saw the photo, it's on one of my slides. Yeah, but check it out yourself, it's a really cool thing. Do you know, when Deng Xiaoping went to the White House, invited by President Carter, who was then the president, he, Deng, the Chinese communist, insisted to have Nixon invited. And here, remember, Nixon, who flew out of the White House, being basically had to resign in front of the possible impeachment or the certain impeachment. And the man who was in disgrace in America, he was the first time back in the White House at the reception on the request of Communist China. I mean, this was in 79. It's quite historic. Yeah? Anyhow, I digress. That's maybe not important. What I want to say is, yeah, this was tremendously important, this new alliance, even when it very complicated always was our relation with China. It was very complicated. It was absolutely decisive to ultimately win the confrontation with the Soviet Union. And the very same logic is now today. What this last 10 years of China bashing has achieved, and not inclusion of China into the Western system, and also this rubber weakness since 2013 of Obama and then Trumpian bashing, was of course alienating China and driving it more and more into Putin's camp, who built these BRICS, and then the Chinese built the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and that's all pretty bad. And we have to come back to this origin of this strategy, especially when China, when Russia is going now in this difficult phase with Navalny, by the way, free Navalny, with Navalny getting 3 years in a gulag for basically not being poisoned, because he couldn't somehow correspond with the court because he was in a coma and he was then in Germany. So he didn't fulfill his kind of bail obligations. It's totally ridiculous. And so he is now sent to the gulag. And the situation is that this problem with China, with Russia, will not go away. So even more we have to work with China and to engage. And here you will ask me what this all has to do with trade. No, very much. The Americans have led this debate with the most favored nation status, then also got, despite all the complications, China has every year been renewed in the most favored nation status, even after the most terrible atrocities of the Tiananmen. And I was personally, as a student, I was protesting for free China and against for the students. I remember very well, and I'm really terribly sorry for what happened. It was a really a shocking moment in world history. Yeah, but, you know, that was terrible. Yeah? But even after this terrible thing, the most favored nation status was renewed, because it really made sense. It made sense in geostrategic terms, and it makes sense today. And actually now it's permanent because of the WTO membership. And now, anyhow, the next step is obviously to open China further, to have this this Chinese investment agreement, which the European Union already has signed now in December, and was heavily criticized by all the people who have heard the same time, the first time from Uyghurs. And by the way, freedom for the Uyghurs, absolutely. But we have to do it differently, not by alienating China or cutting trade ties, but by trading more and inviting China more in the structures of the Western organizations. Absolutely. China, please join the OSZE. That is very good. Let's discuss about these old issues. Let's discuss labor standards. Let's discuss these prison camps. Let's improve them, obviously, and let's free as many prisoners as possible. And let's make sure that the Hong Kongese have a decent life and their rights protected. We will not make any compromises, but we will not work with blackmail or with cutting trade ties and by trying to drive China further to hostile Russia, because there is no aggressive Russia anywhere. There is no Russian tanks anywhere outside of China. And that's the most important. And China has meticulously tried to keep a peace with the West since the most favored nation status was signed. Despite all the complications, this strategic partnership has been strong and very successful. And there's a reason why China has now 14 trillion GDP, because it was integrated in all these Western institutions, Western-built institutions. And exactly that has to continue. I want to explain one more concept. This is very important here to understand, because what? You know, it's so-called the great power paradoxon. In my view, I call it like this. I don't know what the political scientists say, but the thing is, once you are a great power and you have this luck like America after the First World War, you are a great power, you are basically managing the system. You are part of the system. Yeah? You are basically an adult in the room. That's one of the terms. How can I say? You are basically part of the establishment in a way. That means if you then get in a situation where you then change the system, you risk a lot. What I want to say with that is China is now at 14 trillion, an important creditor nation of the world, an important infrastructure provider, an important manufacturing hub, an important science hub, and you know, you are part of the system. So then how is your interest to take that system down that made you so successful? Obviously, you know, they want to be much more taken seriously, much more important in the global level. Yes, yeah. But do they really want to destroy that system? I don't think so. Actually, what China more and more understands also in this crisis, and Belt and Road is one expression, actually something good, that when you are just alone successful, that is the same lesson America had to learn very deeply and the world had to pay very hard. When America withdrew to itself after the First World War, despite being the biggest global power and the rest of the world in complete chaos and destruction, America withdrew and it led to complete chaos. Yeah? And ultimately also, it's not America being guilty for the Second World War, but America being guilty for not taking up its own responsibility for and the global economy in that year, because the global economy collapsed again. And then absolutely that led very much to the Second World War. So what I want to talk, what I want to say here is very important, because China is now and will in the next years even grow much further. And when you compare it in historical terms to what the Japanese have done in the last 30 years of the 19th century, so when you see the population numbers, and China is 10 times the population, so the logical development is that China will have not 14 or 15 trillion, but 50 trillion. Yeah, obviously it will add, it will be one third of the global economy by 2100, maybe. Yeah? It will maybe take 2050 only. Who knows? Yeah. But when you're such an important stakeholder of the world economy, then really you are also a carrier of the global order. You carry it. Yeah? So you're interested to let it fall or to destroy it is not there. And here comes the big difference with Russia, because Russia is only limited internationally connected by capital flight, by energy exports. Yes. Yeah. But Russia is really quite hostile to the current system, because the current system actually is based on the rule of law, and that is not what the Russians believe in. Yeah, of course, you know, the Chinese Communist Party is an authoritarian system. There's no doubt about it. And it has many, many issues. Yeah, and there's 100 issues maybe. But it's ultimately based on the rule of law very much in many aspects. Yeah, and they have the rule of law in many aspects. Not perfect, and there's a lot of intrusions. But they're very much concerned that the world system is working, yeah? And they feel more and more responsibility for it. Yeah? Some in the West, you know, they are racist. They don't want that. Yeah? But we must also build a system where also the Chinese have influence, yeah? And have their seat on the top table, which they anyhow have at the UN. But that's why I also call, let them also be on the table in OSCE. Let's make sure they are also, once the time is coming, they know that they can be also in OECD when they have transformed. Yeah? But let's have a dialogue with them on this. And the thing is, gradually to also give them more rule, more room in the IMF, in all these important organizations. Yeah? Otherwise, they build their own system, which they have started already with BRICS and with Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And we don't want to have a system built by them. That's also an option, but we think, actually, I think our system is working quite well. So with this kind of paradoxon, it's much better to integrate China and to work with China and to contain the real hostile powers, which are Russia and Iran, unfortunately. Also, they will fall one day, but unfortunately, we will have to cope quite a long time, I think, with both of them. So that's my story here for the 1st of February 1918. It's very important, the most favored nation status. It's something technical trade, some people think. No, it gives the right to trade as good and as fair and as open as America gives to other nations. That's the principle of the WTO, most favored nation status. It's really important, it really matters, and that was a historic achievement and a historic turnaround in the world geoeconomics, the 1st of February 1980. And let's celebrate it as a new day, and let's never forget what happened on the day and what exactly happened then the next 40 years, this tremendous improvement of global prosperity because the Chinese decided to be part of the world economy. And that's something to celebrate. Okay, thanks a lot for listening.